Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jim.
What's the story with interest rates?
Well, we've had a lot of policy meetings in the last couple of weeks. Bank of Canada on the 25th of October and the U.S. Central Bank yesterday, the Bank of England today. All of them decided to pause, not make any further change to the overnight rate. So that's interesting. I think it's partly because there's been such a dramatic tightening in financial markets since June, when, you know, asset prices rallied again after a big plunge in 2022. They rallied into sort of mid-year. And the effect of rising prices, whether it be stocks and bonds, when the price of those things rises, what it effectively does is reduce the financing costs for corporations. And it also feeds through to how debt is priced. So it causes yields on bonds and treasuries. When those things fall, then it becomes easier or cheaper for people and companies to borrow money. Well, the opposite happened, of course, in the last couple of months, where we had this big sell-off again in financial markets. And the effect of that is tightening. So there's been an additional, on top of the, you know, 525 basis points of hikes that happened over 18 months, which was already really aggressive and fast, and then we have QT again, the quantitative tapering continuing every single month to roll assets off the central bank balance sheets. That's all additional tightening. And as well, with the big drop in financial markets in the past couple of months, it's the equivalent of another sort of 80 basis points of tightening. So you had the U.S. chair saying yesterday, Powell, that, you know, there's been a lot already, a lot of contraction in terms of credit through the economy, and that they know those things work at a lag, and so they are kind of paying attention. Now, they never say, you know, that's it, we're done, because they're concerned still about a revival in speculative fervor, concerned about a revival in you know, people spending too much and driving inflation back up. So I think that it's very typical of them to pause and be sounding hawkish when they do that, because when they pause, they're seeing some negative stuff. You know, leading indicators have been negative for 19 months now in the U.S. We had an inverted yield curve for about that same length of time. All those are reliable precursors to recession. The Fed knows that. The central banks know that. They look at more coincident data and sort of say, you know, we don't see any big problems. And then, of course, we had the fourth quarter GDP number of the U.S. was 4.9%, so strong. But it's also very common when you have these cycles to have a big GDP print like that on a quarter just before the recession comes in. So it's no way negates the probability that the U.S. economy and Canada are continuing to contract into 2024. Indeed, in Canada, we know that the Canadian GDP actually contracted in the first half of the year at a negative 0.2 annualized rate, and the data we got on August, again, on Halloween, was weak. So the second half is not picking up. So when the central banks say, you know, we're going to just wait here and see how it goes, that's because they see this you know, that inflation has actually come off the boil significantly, and that, you know, unemployment is starting to tick up. So I think that the big rally that we're seeing today, the relief rally that started yesterday when Jerome Powell said that's all we're going to hike, there's a kind of some historical precedent there where if the Fed has paused for two meetings, that they actually didn't go back to hiking rates after that. So that ended up being the final pause. And right now, they've already been on hold since July, right? That was the last hike in Canada and America. So typically, and this is the bit that's kind of important, is that it's one thing to say, oh, great, they're done their hiking. But there's that's bullish for Treasury bonds. That's bullish for government bonds, which we're seeing today. They rally because they've sold off a ton in the last couple of years in response to this very aggressive hiking cycle that's taken place. Stocks are rallying today, too. They're kind of like the dim-witted brother of the bond market, because the reality is that the stock market has never peaked before the central bank, has never bottomed before the central bank has started cutting rates again. So it's fine for them to have this relief rally and say, oh, thank goodness they're done with that, the tightening, if that's in fact the case. Remains to be seen, but it's looking like that could be the case. It's correct in that scenario for treasuries to then rally significantly in the 6 to 12 months after the Fed goes on hold. But it's actually the norm for stock markets to continue to disappoint and fall for many months after this. In fact, the bottom in stocks is typically not in until you've had several quarters of easing again. And, of course, we're nowhere near easing yet. If they're pausing here, you know, the typical pause is many months before they would ever consider cutting again. And in this particular scenario, I think more than any other cycle, probably in my career, because we came into it with inflation as a sticky wicket, that is a sort of a game changer in the sense of central banks want to be very, you know, diligent and remain hawkish against that. So I think this time their impulse to cut rates is going to be delayed more than people are presently anticipating. And I think that I do think they're going to cut rates starting in 2024. Who knows if it's the first quarter, the second quarter. But I don't think they're going to do it as quickly as or to the effect that equity markets in particular are hoping. You know, so they're saying, oh, good, the Wicked Witch is dead. But in fact, the Wicked Witch hasn't even come yet in the form of, you know, the downturn in the earnings cycle, which is starting now, a disappointment, earnings compression because the stock market remains ridiculously overvalued relative to historical norms. So there's a lot more compression yet to come on equity prices. And I think, you know, with Treasury markets rallying today, and again, as I say, the more things rally dramatically like they are today, that in effect, unwind some of the tightening, which makes it more likely that central banks are going to want to be hawkish longer, indeed delay cutting longer. So it's kind of this, you know, perfect circle of misery for the equity market in particular, because the more things appear to rally and loosen, the less likely the central banks are going to come to the rescue with rate cuts. And that's what everybody is kind of breathlessly waiting for.
Is Canada already in recession?
Well, so the Canadian GDP numbers, as I mentioned, did contract in the first half of the year, and it's very likely that we're going to have a weak third quarter as well. So the data is definitely lining up in that regard. And then if we look at the housing market, right, which is the really big black eye for Canada, because we came into this rate hiking cycle with the most outrageously valued homes and the highest debt to disposable income ratios of any of the G10 nations, Canada really is vulnerable. And we know, as we talked many times, that the bulk of our GDP growth in the last decade has in fact come from this big overinvestment in the real estate sector, in particular the residential real estate sector, in particular individual condos and single-family homes. So a massive amount of those were bought by investors because of the low rate environment, which is, of course, not the case now. So we have a bunch of investors trying to exit the space, speculators that were buying in at peak prices and really rock bottom rates a couple of years ago are now finding that they're either, you know, deeply cash flow negative on a monthly basis, which individuals can't keep that up for long. And corporations or institutions that are put together to invest in this space are not up for that either, because they will just hand over keys and liquidate assets, sell things. They're not as sticky in terms of owners. So we're starting to see a lot more listings popping up all over. And the ones that are, they are starting to cut prices, dramatically so, actually. I was writing about this on the blog, of course, this week, because the reality is that at a current, you know, if you look at the U.S. numbers of an 8% mortgage rate, the same $1,850 payment on an 8% mortgage is a home price of about $252 in a conventional mortgage that you can afford. And when rates were, you know, less than 3, people were able to afford about almost twice that, $456,000. So the math of it is that very few people can afford to buy at all in this market, and it's worse than that because of all the people who took on properties at the peak of the price cycle when things were so outrageously priced and rates, of course, were at the lowest ever in history. And so a lot of those people are now struggling because either they had the variable rate mortgages, which was a huge chunk, or they are part of the 60% of mortgages that are coming up for renewal in the next 3 years. Royal Bank's been doing quite a bit of work on this, just talking about the payment shock that's going to hit, and that, you know, we're talking about a third higher payment on $500 trillion of mortgage debt that's up for renewal in the next couple of years. And the thing is, here's, again, goes back to this whole euphoria around, oh, thank goodness they're done hiking. Yeah, but I don't think they're going back to the zero bound. I think that Jay Powell at the helm has really decided that that was a disaster, and it was. It was horrendous. Making money free is totally the wrong incentives. It disincents savings. It encourages speculation and everyone throwing money around like drunken sailors, but it doesn't actually help with productivity or actual investment that helps the economy. So what you get is a bunch of asset bubbles. So, you know, even if they do start cutting interest rates in 24, as we expect, the reality is that they're very likely going to do so in, you know, even if they did a couple of 1%, a couple of 100 basis point cuts, you know, you're not going to get back to the zero bound like interest rates were in the pandemic and in 21. And so that means that housing prices still have to come down significantly further. And the people who bought or levered or increased their debt when prices were too high, or a lot of people did these deposits on projects that were coming up in the near future. And I follow a lot of Reddit boards and different realtors in the space, and they're posting constantly about people looking to get out of properties. There was a story in the Toronto Star today about Toronto area buyers walking away from deposits they've had on new homes where they lose the deposit, in some cases several $100,000, but they literally can't get appraisals. So, you know, just an example of the purchase price they agreed on some time ago or a couple of years ago was $1 million as an example. And as they come up to closing, now that the thing's made, they're trying to get financing. Well, the appraisals are coming in at $600,000. So that's a 40% decline. And so they can't possibly get enough funds together to close these deals. This is the reality on the ground in terms of what this rate cycle has done. And, you know, it is a very positive thing in the big picture, because houses should not have been as insanely valued. And there's still many multiples more than household income can afford in America, in Canada, in many countries, actually. And so this is a very necessary cooling off or repricing cycle, but it's obviously causing a lot of angst and pain and defaults and, you know, people having to move and all sorts of things. Now, on the upside, the good news is that a lot more properties are coming back on the rental market, and we're starting to see apartment vacancy rates tick up, which is great because this is where, you know, people that are actual workers and regular people in the economy need places to live that are affordable. So this is definitely going in the right direction in terms of that. But the volume of people who can purchase continues to weaken, and home building stocks in general have fallen about 20% since July, because although new home builders were offering all these incentives to get people into contracts and buying down the interest rate for the first year and all this sort of thing, obviously that kind of stuff isn't free, and it really hits their profits. Now they're being stuck with people walking away from deals. They can't find buyers. Their profits are under attack, and they're dealing with the higher rate environment as well on their own financing. So all of this is really putting, as I've said, a big cash crunch throughout the economy on many levels.
Are people abandoning the deposits they put down on condos that were being built or houses that were being built?
Yeah, that's what I was just saying. Yeah. They've walked away from a lot, and it's, you know, even if someone wanted desperately to close and wanted to, you know, complete the transaction, if they can't get financing, then they can't, and they are at risk of being sued for the balance. But if enough of this happens in volume, of course, it becomes a problem for the builders and the lenders, obviously, that have made debts that come up for refi and the people can't actually refinance them or can't actually pay or find new financing, then that all kind of rolls back hill. And that's why the banks are starting to have a lot of big provisions for loan losses set aside, bad debts. All the credit card companies, credit card delinquencies are at the highest level in 22 years. So there's a ton of evidence that households, the bankruptcy rate in the United States, corporate bankruptcies are up 30% year over year. Consumer, household, Canadian data, all tons and tons of data suggesting that this cash crunch is for real. It's not going to be fixed by the Fed going on pause. Now the treasury bonds are rallying today, so that will help in terms of mortgage rates somewhat. You know, like the 5-year mortgage rate or the 5-year treasury yield was about 4.5 at the peak at the start of October, and it's back below 4% again. Ultimately, that will translate into some reduction in mortgage rates, but not nearly enough to help the people who bought too much and levered too high at next to zero.
Will a rising number of foreclosures mean there will be more affordable homes on the market?
Well, it's sticky, right? It takes a while, but ultimately, yes, because as they say, lenders and investors tend to have a short patience for sitting there with negative carry assets, and they do have clearing events where they just say, okay, and I'm watching that in the listings, like houses that, you know, sold for 1.1 or 1.2 in October of 21 are selling now for 880. Like, so, you know, that's a hell of a haircut in a very short period of time, in 1 year. And that's because, you know, it was a ridiculous price when it was purchased. Now, the thing is, though, if you look back to, you know, even the last 4 years, prices, even at the discounts we're starting to see, prices are still 40% higher than they were, you know, 2 and 3 years before the pandemic. So that problem is going to take longer to fix. And of course, individuals have these ideas of what they want to sell the property for, and very often that's related to how much leverage they have, and they have to pay off a certain amount of debt, so they go, well, I can't sell it for less than X. But as time goes on, people realize that X isn't coming anytime soon, and they start to either, as I say, default, and it becomes the lender's problem, or they just have to take whatever they can get to get out of a scenario.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, could China's real estate crisis with Evergrande and Country Garden, it seems, going down the garden path, could that real estate crisis cross the Pacific to Canada and the U.S.?
Sure. I mean, it's very like what we saw in the 80s with the Japanese property bubble, which was enormous. And it was a stock market bubble as well. It was predicated by low interest rates and speculation, all the usual ingredients that we've had here. And when the property bubble finally burst, what happened was, you know, a lot of lenders went bankrupt, a lot of investors lost money, a lot of individuals lost their homes. Again, because many of them bought more than they could afford when prices were in the frenzy. And so just any kind of normalization in rates ends up being catastrophic in that environment. But you also see a repatriation of capital back from international markets. So, you know, we know that a lot of fund flows came from China into Canada in the past decade, particularly into about 2021. And there was a lot of hope in the you know, as we entered 2022 was bad for every asset class. We entered 2023, and there was a lot of talk about China's reopening again. You know, this back to that old treasure where everyone thinks, well, the Chinese government is going to just, you know, inflate the hell out of everything because they're communists and they're not going to tolerate any downside. At some point, the weight of it becomes, you know, enormous and more than any one country or one central bank can offset. And so that's certainly happening where you've got the Chinese property market's been unraveling for a couple of years already. You've got a lot of that reflected in even the Chinese stock market because, again, like Canada, a huge amount of Chinese growth was based on the property sector building out in the last decade, and a lot of the lenders and the builders, developers became a good concentration of companies that traded on the public markets. So you had investor flows from all over the world coming into that space. And the same thing is now unwinding because property prices have been dropping and people are generally, this feeds into consumer sentiment, which you're seeing a very negative impact in China in terms of households. They're very much feeling like they've been had, like they're losing their shirts, like very unhappy in the masses. This is starting to spread in Canada, of course. This is a mirror image of what when people realized they thought they were winning, they thought they were getting away with something during the pandemic and the mania that went on as prices went up. And then as prices come back down, they start to get very angry and depressed and feel like they've, you know, made some mistakes. So that's happening, and capital flows are reversing from the rest of the world as cash needs to come back to China to try and cover some of their deficits and their debts. The Chinese stock market has given back the entire gains that it saw in the, you know, reopening meme from like November of last year into early sort of January, February, and it's, you know, back below that level again now. So a lot of this goes back to my thesis all along, which was that we were heading into a recession in 2019 before the pandemic hit. All of the, you know, the PMIs, the U.S. manufacturing PMI is negative. We just got its contraction mode, new orders, contraction, the weakest level since 2020, again, just this week, 14th month of contraction. This is something we've seen in all the European PMI data. This is something that we're seeing really worldwide, which is there was such an enormous jump in demand for especially durable goods, hard goods, that kind of thing, which was largely driven by the frenzy in the real estate market because a lot of people were, well, I need new appliances, I need, you know, a new boat, I need all these things. That was all cheap money and frenzy. And now people are realizing that they can't keep a lot of that stuff because they are asset heavy and cash light. And so you've got this wave reversing, and a lot of things are coming back to retest their lows of 2020. So they bought this revival or this resurgence on, you know, on basically government funds, which were handed out, and cheap money from central banks. The two monetary policy and fiscal policy together purchased an extension of the cycle, which was already at its end in 2019, and made it go on for a couple more years. But now we have the offsetting period, right, where they have to take back all of the free stuff they gave out. And we know that the multiplier effect on debt financing is a short-term blip followed by long-term take-back. It's like you've moved a hole further out in your driveway, but you still got the hole, and now you have to deal with it. That's basically what we're finding. So the world's awash in excess supply of things because people have too many things and everyone's looking to raise cash. So ultimately, this is disinflationary, and it's starting to push down the inflation and the excess pricing that we saw during the pandemic. But it's going to take a while, right? Because incomes have not kept up with the increase in all these things. And as I say, there's a clearing event that takes some time. And eventually we'll get prices back down to match with income, and we'll go from there.
Danielle, thank you so much for being on the show.
Hey, thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her website's jugglingdynamite.com and venablepark.com. If you have any questions for Danielle or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Find us on X at House Street. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.